Have your Bibles with you. I'd ask you to open them this evening to 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. I'd like to give our attention to that passage this evening. And before we actually begin that study, Adam did a good job of introducing us to our theme for the month in regards to being lights in the world and focusing on our good work and our memory verses from Matthew chapter 5. In verse 14, this one ought to be fairly familiar to everybody, and so this one shouldn't be terribly hard if you want to say it together with me. If you can do it without opening your eyes, I mean, close your eyes and say it, just open them back up before we start preaching, okay? So, Matthew 5 and verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. 1 Samuel chapter 17, beginning in verse 1, reads this. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Soko and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side. Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span, something like 9.5 feet or so. He had a bronze helmet on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, maybe 125 pounds. He had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, about 15 pounds. A shield bearer went before him. And he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you be our servants and serve us." The Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed, greatly afraid. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, who had 8 sons. The man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul, and the 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of these 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. And Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper and ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. And as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, for they were dreadfully afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches, will give him his daughter, give him his father's exemption, his house exemption from taxes in Israel." David spoke to the men who stood by and saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" The people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, when he heard him speak to the men, Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart. You've come down to see the battle." David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause? So he turned from him toward another and said the same thing. And the people answered him as at the first. And when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You're not able to go fight against this Philistine. You're a youth, and he a man of war from his youth." David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught him by its beard and I struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his armor and put a bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened his sword to his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these. I've not tested them." So David took them off, and he took his staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, put them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch that he had, and his sling was in his hand. And he drew near to the Philistine. So when the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him, and when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy, good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come out to me with sticks?" The Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me. I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all the assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." So it was when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And he put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and he slung it. And he struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead. And he fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword and drew out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. The men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted, pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shaaraim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. But he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of his army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" Abner said, "As your soul lives, king, I do not know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." And then as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" So David said, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite." That may be my favorite Bible story. And every time I read, this was part of our Bible reading this week. And kind of like last week, you read these things over and over. And it's interesting how they strike you maybe differently each time. Or maybe they just remind you of things that you've already thought about. And with everything that's kind of been going on in the last year or two, and as my kids are getting older, and as I'm watching the world, and we're looking at the election coming up, and Supreme Court justices are dying, and Target, you can't go in there and figure out which restroom to use, and you know, all this stuff that's happening. Some of these stories start making more sense to me. I got to thinking about this week as I was reading this. I think it was Friday that was this reading. And I got to thinking, I wonder why it is that God chose this story to put in the Old Testament. I mean, David reigned for 40 years, just like Saul reigned for 40 years and Solomon reigned for 40 years. And when you get right down to it, we think we know a lot about these guys, and we really know very little. We know more about the time that Saul was chasing David and trying to kill him than we know about any other period during David's reign. We practically know nothing about Saul's reign other than the very beginning and some of the mistakes that he made, and very little, if anything, about Solomon's reign other than the stuff that he built. And so when God includes a story in such detail as this, you know, you start thinking, okay, what is it that's here that God is so intent upon making an impact on us? This is not necessarily an unusual event. If you read the chronicles of David's mighty men at the end of his reign, there were several of David's relatives, actually one of David's brothers, if I remember right, that they killed giants too. You know, David's not the only guy to kill a giant. And there were all kinds of remarkable things that happened in battle. Why this story? Well, I would offer two propositions, and then I want to make a couple of observations about the story itself. I would propose, first of all, that this story is included at this point in the Old Testament record because God is introducing us to a man after His own heart. What's just preceded is the coronation of Saul and Saul's repeated failures of faith, that he didn't do things the way God asked him. And God tells him on two occasions, back in chapter 13 and then again in chapter 15, that He's going to take the kingdom from him. And in one place He says, I'm going to give it to a man after my own heart. And another place He says, that I'm going to give it to a neighbor of yours that's better than you. That had to have hurt Saul. And as David has been anointed to be the next king in the previous chapter, now we see this wonderful story where he accomplishes great things, even though he's a skinny, scrawny, ruddy, red-headed, good-looking kid. But not the kind of guy that's going to go out and fight against a giant of his own strength and his own power. But this is part of what sets him apart against Saul. And there's a real contrast going on. The second proposition I would make, though, and what I think is really the bigger one, for us anyway, is that this story tells us a lot about God. At a time when the nation of Israel has rejected God as their king, and God is trying to move them back in the direction of what a real king in the eyes of God ought to be. David's going to be the prototype for Jesus. And God's trying to get that firmly established. God wants us to understand, look, here's the way that I will do things when the right person's in the right place and that person trusts me. In the book of Romans in chapter 15 and verse 4, we're told that the things that were written beforehand were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. And sometimes we study the Old Testament, we forget that. That there are 1,500 years worth of history in the Old Testament. But God chooses the things that He tells us for us so that we can read the Scriptures and put our faith in God. Paul says this, that very thing earlier in Romans in chapter 10 and verse 7. Faith comes by hearing the Word of God. So I read this story about David and Goliath, and yeah, I learn a lot about David, but what I learn more is to put my trust in God. And so I want to make a couple of observations about trusting in God from the story of David and Goliath, because they have kind of helped me this week as I've thought about life and what's going on in the world. And here are my observations. There are a lot of others we could make, but here are mine for now. You read this story and you're reminded that sometimes your enemies can be absolutely overwhelming. I'll say that again. When you read the story of David and Goliath, the first thing that jumps out at you is our enemies can be absolutely overwhelming. And that's a pretty common Old Testament image. We're introduced to Goliath. What do we know about him? Well, he's a giant. 9'6", 7'8", 9", something like that. And we go, wow, that's big. We got no idea. Do you remember, what was the y'all remember Yao Ming used to play basketball for the Houston Rockets? He was, what, 7 foot and some change, 7'4", something like that. When Haley was a senior in high school, they got to go sing the national anthem at the Rockets game. And the choir walks out onto the court as they're warming up, and all the players line up, and they go down there to sing, and here's, you know, big, tall Haley, all 5 foot of her, and she would argue that, by the way, and she's standing, and I kind of know how tall she is, and she walks up, and as they're waiting to sing, and they're standing there, I look up, and Yao Ming walks right up next to her. And she barely came up to his waist, or at least that's the way it looked to me. And I saw her look up at him, and she was... I mean, I want you to think about this for a second. It's what it would have been like if David walked up to Goliath. And you know, we get the facts in our head, but we don't get the perspective in our head. You take a full-grown man that's a big man, 6 foot, 6 foot four, 6 foot five, Goliath would have towered over him. He's wearing a coat of mail that weighs just the coat, 125 pounds. You go tote around 125 pounds for a while. And his spear has got a head on it that is 15 pounds in weight. If they just hit you with that, regardless of the point, it would kill you. And we read the story and we get it. We think of all the pictures in the kids' books. But this is not a kid's story. These are real men who are having to face this guy in hand-to-hand combat. And I want you to recognize that that's very often the basis of some of the stories God tells us in the Old Testament. I don't think they're fictional stories. They're real stories. But very often the story begins with, look how overwhelming the enemy is. Joshua goes into the land of Canaan. What's the first thing he runs into? The city of Jericho, and there's walls around it. And the spies have already told them, look, the cities have walls around them, and there's giants in the land, and we're like a bunch of grasshoppers next to them, and they're well-trained men. And the enemy was impressive. How many times do you read in the stories of the judges or the stories of the kings that they're going out to fight, and the armies of the enemies were like a locust plague, and the chariots with wheels of iron were overwhelming. Or you think about Pharaoh in Egypt, and every time you turn around in a Bible story, the enemies are overwhelming. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, and here's where that translates to us. Paul reminds us right at the end of this letter, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. Well, we don't have 9.5-foot enemies that we have to fight against hand-to-hand combat. But against principalities and powers and darkness and the rulers of darkness of this age and spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. And I tell you, we're very conscious of the enemies that we face. Are you feeling a little overwhelmed by what's happening in the government right now? I mean, I've heard it in this room. Man, I don't know what we're going to do this year. I'm not crazy about either one of the candidates. I don't know who we're going to vote for. If you vote for this, this is going to happen. You vote for this, this is going to happen. What are we going to do? And you kind of start the hand-wringing thing. And what about the next Supreme Court justice? And you know, what about these laws that are being passed? And what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And we look around and we realize that we got giants in front of us sometimes. You look at the education system. I'm not necessarily opposed to the education system, but the academic world is certainly not promoting the concept of God and faith in this day and age. And I think about my kids in school. I think about kids in college. I think about your kids in school. I think about the influence of the academic world and science upon the media and upon news. And that's a little overwhelming to think about what's out there opposing us. You think about your job. Do you have to deal with dishonesty and lack of integrity? Do you constantly have to compete with people who are cheating and lying and stealing? And yet you're trying to do things right and you recognize that puts you at an economic disadvantage? Or you're competing with people in your job? And they have absolutely no moral qualms about backstabbing or undercutting or or cheating you, and the next thing you know, you're worried about your own place and your own profession. Kids in school, do you notice the immorality and the ungodliness, and just do you feel like you're standing alone, swimming upstream? And what about the immorality and the perversion around us, and what's happening in our communities, and we got health issues, and we're frustrated, and we're discouraged, and we're depressed, and people are fighting battles right and left, and we ain't even got to the big ones yet. You deal with temptation on a regular basis? You have sins that you've committed that you're trying to grapple with? How do I get past what I've done in my life? You worry about dying? There's lots of giants that we face in the Scriptures. And I'm convinced part of the reason God keeps telling us these stories is because we've got giants that we have to face as well. And there's really two options that are presented in all these stories. And they are well represented in this story. You've got Saul, head and shoulders, bigger than everybody else. And he and all the Israelites are cowering in fear. And you've got David, who walks out in the middle because he trusts in God. And it occurs to me, folks, that that's the way we face stuff in our life. If we're going to be Christians, those are our two options. You're either going to be afraid of everything that's going on around you, or you're going to trust in God. So I want you to take note of the fact that your enemies can appear really overwhelming. Second observation. It's faith that keeps fear in check. What was it about David that he goes out there and faces this giant? Well, I think there are all kinds of possibilities, but do you think he was in any way afraid of Goliath? And be careful about answering that, because I think we always want to go, he wasn't afraid at all. I'm not sure that I believe that. And I don't think it's an issue that he wasn't afraid. I think the issue was, he remembered that God's a lot bigger than that 9.5-foot giant standing on the other side of that field. And it is that trust in God and God's power and God's might and God's force and what God has done and what God promises that He will do. That's what balanced out what had to be some degree of natural fear. I'm going to tell you something. If you had to go in hand-to-hand combat with somebody 3 or 4 foot taller than you, there would be something wrong with you if you weren't afraid to some degree. That would be an exceptionally natural reaction. And I don't believe for a minute that David didn't feel it. I believe he did. In 2 Kings chapter 6, when Elisha becomes the prophet, and we learn a lot about Elisha at this point in time, and the Syrians are fighting against the Israelites, and the Syrian army is setting an ambush trying to capture the king of Israel. And Elisha keeps sending word to the king of Israel. And finally the Syrians figure out that Elisha is the one that's feeding information to the king of Israel. So the Syrian king sends his army after Elisha, and he catches him in Dothan. And Elisha's servant walks out one morning and he looks and the whole mountain is surrounded by the army of the Syrians. And he's scared to death. And this is the story where we get the song, Open Our Eyes That We May See. Elisha prays to God on behalf of his servant. Open his eyes that he may see. And he looks around and what he sees is the angelic armies of God surrounding the armies of the Syrians. And that happens after Elisha utters the words, those that are for us are more than those that are for them, which has got to be one of the most comical moments in the Old Testament, because you know his servant had to think, Elisha has lost it. There's two of us and a gazillion of them. And what's always impressed me about that story is that army of angels, they were there before that young man saw them. And that's one of the lessons that God keeps telling us over and over and over. And it seems to me that that was the thing that David understood. That God has the greater force on his side. That if God's involved or God's people involved, there's always more that are for us that are against us. And over and over and over, God keeps offering the same message. If you go all the way back to Deuteronomy, in the first six chapters, when Moses, after spending 40 years in the wilderness with these people, is sending them off into the promised land, God tells them three or four different times, don't be afraid of the giants. Don't be afraid of the people of the land. Don't be afraid of the big cities. Don't be afraid of them. Fear me. Don't be afraid of them. Fear me. It is a resounding theme that runs through those chapters. If you're going to be afraid of someone, be afraid of somebody that can do some damage. In the book of Luke in chapter 12, that's what Jesus tells His apostles when they're confronted with the Pharisees. And He says, look, don't fear those who can kill you and after that have nothing more than they can do to you. But I tell you who you need to fear. You need to fear Him who, after He kills you, can cast your soul into hell. That's who you fear. And I'm going to tell you, if we have that kind of concept of God, that He's bigger and stronger and more powerful than anything we face, whether it is the evolutionary promotion of our society, whether it's the immorality that's all around us, whether it is the gunk that you have to face at work, whether it is the peer pressure that you face on the job or at school, no matter what it is, the proper perspective of trust remembers that God's bigger, God's stronger, no giants are going to stand up against Him, no army's greater than His army. And therefore, I need to stand up and do my job. I need to be a light in this world, doing good works when everybody around me could care less. I'm going to tell you, folks, that's when your trust is really tested. It's when you're facing your giant, and I'm facing mine. It's not days when everything's good. It's when the world's falling apart. That's when you're really going to tell whether you trust God or not. And when our trust is well placed, even though we may have some natural degree of fear, that's when we do our job anyway. Let me ask you a question. You ever try to talk to somebody about the gospel? Are you nervous about that because you're not exactly sure what to say and what passages to use? Well, what do you do about that? Do you trust that, okay, I may not say everything right, but the power's in the Word. And if I can just get them to the Word, that if their heart's right, they're going to respond to it. Or do you cower in fear because you're afraid that you don't know what to say? I mean, that's one of our giants, folks. And when our faith is well placed, it keeps that fear in perspective. I'm not trying to talk somebody into salvation. I'm trying to show them what God says. So let's show them what God says. Because faith ought to keep fear in its proper place. Third observation. Look at verse 47 in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Best thing that David says, not my favorite thing, but the best thing that he says, is when he's talking to Goliath, and he says, all the assembly will know that the Lord doesn't save with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's. We need to remember that. If you go back, I had never noticed this before this week. If you go back and read the story, which we just read, do you appreciate that God is never mentioned in this story till David comes along? I found that kind of interesting. When Saul's armies and the Philistine armies get together, we have all the geography, and then we have Goliath coming out. And Goliath's challenge in verse 8 is, am not I a Philistine and you the servants of Saul? He doesn't say, am I not a servant of Dagon and you the servants of Yahweh? He doesn't mention that. Goliath's not trusting in any god. Goliath's trusting in the fact that he's got 125 pounds of armor on, a 15-pound weight in the head of his spear, and he's head and shoulders, probably waist and shoulders, taller than everybody else out there. He's not trusting in his God. And what's even more fascinating about that is he keeps coming out, verse 10, I defy the armies of Israel. And Saul and all the Israelites, they're cowering in their tents. And David comes along in verse 26 and says, what are we going to do about this? What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he would defy the armies of the living God? When David looked at this battle, David didn't see the servants of Saul and the Philistines. David saw the servants of God and the Philistines. And I must tell you, folks, and we preach this all the time. I don't know how many times I've heard Adam say it. I don't know how many times I've said it. I don't know how many times elders have said it. It is our spiritual perspective that is the most important part of the armor that we're putting on. That we keep in mind who it is that we're serving. If you go back and you look, it is right after this that David's standing up and going, oh, it's God that he's defied. And that's when, in verse 28, David's oldest brother pulls him aside and says, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. You just came out here to watch the battle. And you can figure out what's in Eliab's head and what he thinks about David. You stupid kid. You young, naive kid. You don't know how battle works. Yeah, you're standing over there talking about God like it's some big deal. You're not about to go out there and fight that giant. When all the time David's going, yeah, I'm about to go out there and fight that giant because I've got God on my side. And it is a fascinating thing to me to see how Eliab looks in regards to David's kind of young, naive, idealistic mentality when David's the one who's got the right perspective. This is God's war. This is the battle that belongs to the Lord. The Philistines are God's enemies. And when he mentions, when he talks to Goliath, what he says very clearly is, when I'm finished, everybody's going to know that there's a God in Israel. It doesn't matter that it's Saul's servants, and it doesn't matter that it's Israel against the Philistines. What matters is everybody's going to know, in verse 46, that there is a God in Israel and that God's the one who wins the battles. And that's what we have to remember. I don't know what's going to happen in this country. You young people, listen very carefully. I don't know what's going to happen in your lifetime. I really believe this. It is going to be harder for you to be faithful to the Lord than it has been for my generation and the generation before me. I really believe that. You better buckle your seatbelts. You better cinch up your saddles because you're going to face some giants. But the battle's always going to be God's. Read the book of Revelation, and the whole theme of Revelation is, yeah, they're killing you. Yeah, it looks like God's losing. Yeah, it looks like the Romans are winning. But God's going to take care of this, and God's going to win. And we can look back and see that that's exactly what happened. And honestly, folks, that is the Bible story. That's what Satan thought when he killed Jesus. I won. 3 days later, Jesus arises. God won. And it's over and over and over. God's always winning for his people. So here's what that does for us in practical terms. It reminds us that this kind of faith in God, we can win battles. We can teach people the gospel. We can stand up against the immorality. We can do whatever we need to do to go out and be lights in this world and to do good things in the middle of a wicked and perverse generation. And we can slay whatever giants are in front of us. You know, there's a similar kind of incident right at the end of Jesus' life. In Matthew chapter 21, when Jesus is in the temple, and this is just a couple of days before he's killed. And they're walking into the temple one day, and this is in Matthew chapter 21, beginning the story in Matthew's account, begins in about verse 18. And Jesus sees a fig tree. And with that time of the year, leaves on the figs. He expected there to be figs on it, and there's none there. And so he curses the fig tree. And the next morning as they come by, the fig tree is dead, withered, it says, from the root up. And the apostles are amazed at that. Now, why at this point in Jesus' ministry that would amaze them, I don't know, but it does. And they remarked how quickly the fig tree is dead. And Jesus' reply to them, surely I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but also if you say to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, it will be done. And all things, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. Now, we recognize that there are other provisions. And he's not telling them, you can tell the Mount of Olives to go drop in the sea of the Dead Sea and it'll happen just because you want it to happen. There's the will of God. There's a lot of things involved with asking and receiving. But the point he's making to them is, I'm about to die, and you still need to trust what I've been telling you for the last 3 years. And understand that I'm still with you, and God's still with you, and we're still going to win this thing. And that's the kind of thinking that allowed them to go spread the gospel. When they knew the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Romans and the Jews and pretty much everybody they ran into was going to be against them. And they could go some places and they didn't make many converts. But then they could go to some place like Corinth with all of its wickedness and they could stand up and preach. And when Paul left there after some months, there's a group of Christians there. How did they have that kind of guts to stand up and slay those giants? Well, because of these stories. Because they had that kind of confidence they could move mountains. And that's the kind of confidence we have to have. Now let me throw a thing or two out that strikes me about that. Confidence all by itself in God is not going to do us much good. How did David fell Goliath? Well, he took a sling and took a stone, put it in the sling, threw it, hit him in the head, right? Now, he had to have the courage to go out there, but David made this decision, this is why I'm going to attack this guy. And he was very successful in that. And I know probably we think, well, God guided the stone. Maybe he well did. But how many times do you reckon David out there keeping the sheep had thrown stuff with that slingshot at all over the mountains of Judah? Do you think he'd ever practiced any? You think that's the first time he'd ever picked up that slingshot and went, okay, I'll tell you what I can do. I can't beat this guy hand to hand, but I bet you I can hit him in the head with a rock. Now, I've never thrown a rock with a sling before, but I bet you I can do it. Now, come on, think about this in practical terms. Why does he only take a sling and a staff with him? The staff's not going to do him any good. But he knows what he can do with that sling. And I'll tell you, folks, you know, don't walk up to somebody when you won't crack your Bible open and say, I want to talk to you about the gospel and think that somehow or the other God's going to throw the stone right where it needs to go. We still have to be able to point them to the right place. You don't have to make a compelling argument. You don't have to answer every question. But when we come to services and we come to Bible classes and we do our daily Bible reading, we need to give it enough attention that we have practiced with the slingshot so we can at least throw the stone in the right direction. And I think that's just something that's kind of overlooked about that story. And we may have to do that all by ourselves. Nobody goes out there with David. He walked out there all by himself. And that may be the way it has to be on your job, or at your school, or in your family, or in your community. We think, man, we got to organize some kind of grand effort. We need a bunch. No, we don't. Adam made a good point this morning about the fact that we are lights in the world as individuals. And I'm going to tell you, that's the way the gospel was intended to be spread. And I'm not arguing that the church is unimportant, but I'm going to tell you something, folks. If we sit around and wait for some big collective effort to do things, nothing's ever going to get done. You and I every day have to take the sling and fight the giant, even if we have to do it all by ourselves. Remembering that the battle is the Lord's. And then here's my conclusion. I want all you kids to listen. All you young people. David was not a full-grown He-Man at this point. David was a kid. Probably a young teenager. I want you to understand something that God has done throughout the Bible record. He's taken young people who have been well trained in faith, and He's used them. When David is finished with Goliath, do you remember what happens next? It's not Saul that goes charging down that mountainside that those people follow. It's David that army goes running after. David's the only one standing out there on the field of battling. And you want to talk about good works and influence? He stood up. He did what he needed to do. He knew whose battle it was. He knew the right perspective. He faced his fear because of his faith. It didn't matter how big the giant was. And that kid became the king of Israel. Y'all are going to have your giants. I don't know when. But if the country keeps going the way it's going, you better be ready. But you can do this. God used lots of young people. Esther's a young woman. She saves her people. Josiah's a young man. He leads his whole nation in a spiritual revolution. Over and over and over, you've got your Davids, you've got your Jonathans, you've got these Daniel as a kid standing up to the king of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, young men being thrown into a fiery furnace. You young people, don't just sit there and do nothing. You go be lights in the world. Sometimes that's what gets the old people fighting. It's an interesting story. One of my favorite ones. See something in it every time I read it. The battle is the Lord's, folks. And I tell you, we probably got some fighting that we're going to have to do before our lives are over at this point, in this world, in this country. So let's pick up our rocks. Let's get our staff in our hand. Let's go meet the enemy and be lights in the world and do our good works and slay our giants. If you're subject to invitation this evening, we invite your response while we stand and sing.